This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have Roy with us and discussing some topics that I'm pretty sure everyone in SaaS world will be very interested to hear. So welcome to the show, Roy, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me. So my name is Roy, and I'm the leading the revenue architect revenue architect practice at Winning by Design. Winning by Design. We work with VC and PE-backed B2B recurring revenue companies, and we help them build, design, and improve their go-to-market strategies and processes. Mm. And our offering is in terms of consulting, just where the revenue architects come in, like myself, and also training. So training the individual sales rep, customer success reps, the different team members that we have within a go-to-market team, and how to improve their skills and how to better better manage their go-to-market processes.
So whenever we talk about architecture and architects, it reminds me that it's something you need to do at the beginning, or it's better to be done at the beginning, because it might be too late to build a building and then go to architect and say, I want to change something, right? So is it the case with you that on the revenue side, since you are a revenue architect, you rather to work with companies before they get very serious about their go-to-market strategy, or what a stage of the company it's best for you to get involved? Very beginning, post-revenue, maybe when they are bigger and they are, you know, probably at the mode that they are generating revenue and they have a good machinery, but they wanted to just scale it. So can you tell us a little bit about this stage?
Yeah. So, I love your question. I never got that, but I'm smiling because yesterday I just signed a contract with an architect to renovate my house, right? So the house is existing, but I want to make it better. I see that there are rooms for improvement. I want to enlarge a room and improve the way my house is, right? So that's why I bring in an architect. So using this analogy, we work with many types or many stages of companies. We usually start off at around the 10 million ARR. And why do we start at that 10 million ARR? Because at that 10 million, usually companies have a go-to-market, they have found their go-to-market fit. And they have enough data for us to work with in order to really build, improve, design their processes. And when I'm talking about processes, it's the sales process, it's the lead generation, it's the customer success processes. So we are working with any company from 10 million all the way to north of 1 billion company, 1 billion in ARR companies. Different challenges when we work with different stages, right? In the beginning, as you said, it's usually they have been testing out things, but it's Yeah, it's like a clean slate. We usually start off and, okay, you have initial indications, initial data points, and yeah, let's define and build a strategy based on that. And when we're working with more mature companies, is okay, we have reached a certain level, a certain stage. Now, what we need to do in order to take the company and transfer into the next stage of growth. So each one with the different challenges.
One of the terms that you know, I heard from you was revenue factory. When you know, I read what you have written, and revenue factory, it resembles kind of a scalability, right? So you have the kind of revenue, but now you want to make it faster, growing, and you can scale. When you talk about 10 million ARR, they have a small factory. At that point, they haven't started to kind of, it's a factory in a way, but it's a very small scale factory. And then probably at that point, you look at it and say, how to make it scalable, how to scale. How do you see and how do you define revenue factory?
Yeah. It starts off with our claim that when you think of it, in a recurring, in our industry, recurring revenue, mostly B2B recurring revenue businesses, there are no standards. There are no guidelines. We don't know how to build SaaS companies. We do know, but we don't have the frameworks and models and how to architect recurring revenue companies. A lot of the things that we do is based on our experience from our previous companies or what we heard in an event that some founder, leader, executive did successfully in one company and tried to copycat that. But we're not focusing on or using models and frameworks in order to design that. And coming back, why do we use like a revenue factory? Because when you think of it, the manufacturing industry, they do have a lot of standards. They do have a lot of protocols and frameworks and models on which if you want to build a manufacturing, a food and beverage manufacturing company, you have a lot of data and frameworks, models to base, to design and architect how you want to build that factory. So we believe that companies at a certain point, which again, usually 10 million, plus or minus, you can start using that in order to create a factory. And you should consider, for example, each go-to-market motion, each segment, each product as their own production line. And looking at it from a production line from, we call it, from the initial customer journey all the way to retention and expansion. So looking at across the different silos and departments that we have, and this is like a go-to-market kind of way of looking at things rather than departmentalizing and siloing the customer journey. So that's the concept of a revenue factory.
And from your perspective, looking at, for example, you know, $10 million ARR company versus, let's say, $50 million ARR company, how do the challenges kind of change and shift? Or you may say 100 million, doesn't matter. But I wanted to get a better understanding of the challenges and the way they evolve.
Fantastic. So I kept on saying frameworks and models. One of the models that we have is the growth model. So observing where companies have challenges in the different growth stages allowed us to create a model. And we see common breaking points, we call them breakpoints, as they grow. And as you said, we have different challenges for 10 million ARR. There, it's usually around, let's understand what works, focus on what works, and stop doing what does not work, right? So in the beginning, when we're finding our product market fit or even go to market fit, we're trying out different things and we're selling to this type of customers and this segment and this industry, and one ACV is this high and the other contract is that low. One sales cycle takes us 9 months and the other one takes us 9 weeks. So we're testing out different things. At that 10 million, you need to double down on one in order to start scaling the business, right? So that's usually the focus of that 10 million. When we're talking about later stage companies, sometimes it happens at 50, sometimes it happens at 100, sometimes it happens at 250, right? We need to start working on creating an effective process, an efficient process. Right, so let's do more with less. Let's be able to increase, if we're talking about a factory, increase the output and the quality of the output. And that's usually like we measure that as a productivity per rep. Can we increase our productivity, our revenue per rep? So these are just this type of focus that we have for that 50, 100 million stages.
We have seen different stages in software world and, you know, decade over decade, right? So let's talk about very original version of the income and revenue that was perpetually, you know, selling the software and getting the one-time fee plus a percentage for support and maintenance. And then going through the subscription model that is more associated with SaaS. And then some other models like usage-based, for example, model. And now AI coming to the mix. It's going to change also some of those equations. And especially when it comes to cost of delivery of the software, that is another factor that also would be very different when you ship the software on CD-ROM or host it and serving it as a service, or for example, you know, going and making it more AI kind of and selling your model and training your data and probably more cost, you know, being kind of upfront cost being accrued.
Yep.
Now, when it comes to this kind of evolution and this kind of changing the model and pricing and everything, how do you see that may impact, you know, the kind of companies that you wanted to speak with and architect that kind of revenue machinery and factory for them?
You touch on... this falls under another model that we talk about. This is the revenue model. We have an ownership kind of model, perpetual, either hardware or software. The classical, hey, you buy upfront and get the software on a CD-ROM. And then we've got the subscription-based. Early 2000s, I don't know if they're the first ones, but they are known to do that. Salesforce came in and said, not only everything is on the cloud, but we're selling you a CRM that Microsoft Dynamics sells for millions of dollars. We're going to sell you per seats, $100 a seat per month. So that's the subscription model. And then we've got the consumption model by usage. That's usually that, or by impact, by action. And that's the third model. What you sell, it's not so much as, you know, your question is, what do you want? Who do you want to work with? It's not so much, but it's different. It's a different company. It's a different company, as you said, that sells upfront. And in that case, the risk is mostly on the buyer because they pay upfront and whatever happens after that, it's their problem. Into subscription, that all of a sudden we bear the risk because we know that our customers will churn if they don't get that impact. And on the other side, consumption, we're not going to get paid if they don't achieve, we call it achieving impact, if they don't get the business outcome of what they signed up for, right? So the companies are completely different. And we need to understand, if we're from a company perspective, where are we playing? How does that influence the win rate, the retention, the ACV, all that needs to be taken into account.
But also I wanted to probably learn more and ask from this angle that the pricing model, how much is involved into that kind of building that revenue architecture, right? Or how impactful? You may say, well, pricing model is by far number one focus, especially for this stage of companies or this size of the companies. Or you may say that actually is not a big piece and pricing model is not something I would look at it as one of the top five things I look at. And there are many other things that are more impactful in what the company does in order to build a kind of revenue factory. So maybe I can rephrase the question that way so we can understand from your perspective and the way you do it as revenue architect, how important do you see the pricing to be in all these equations?
This is the first step that we need to get right.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, it makes it very important to get that right. The pricing, and we call it pricing and packaging because it goes hands in hand.
Yeah.
And that's when you have a product, you're ready to go to market. That's the first thing. How much are we going to charge for that? That's mm-hmm. the number one thing. It's very important. It's very important in the beginning because naturally, as the company progresses and grows, then it's very important, but you are probably doing something right because you can continue to grow. And of course, if you get the pricing and packaging wrong, that will cause you to slow down or even stop your growth. But yeah, assuming that you continue to grow, that means that you've got pricing and packaging okay, and then your focus shifts on other stuff.
Your name, the name of your entity, Winning by Design, it indicates that you are searching for the science behind winning.
Yep.
And that's a billion-dollar question, right? So everyone wants to know, what is that science? If it has been figured out, that's great. I want that kind of formula because yep. it definitely helps me. Do I kind of interpret it correctly? And that's what you really, your intention was when you named that, you know, winning by design, meaning that you are actually suggesting offering that kind of, you know, science behind winning?
Yes, I think we do. That's exactly our intention. However, we do understand that we're talking about a very complex ecosystem, right? So even if we design the best process, the best go-to-market, we architected a fantastic revenue factory, there are other things that come into place, right? So the product could be not as great. Mm-hmm. The competition might introduce something that completely disturbed our market, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have, I don't know, people problem in terms of the company. We're running out of money. So a lot of different problems. And again, this is what makes our industry very interesting, right? Because it's so complex. And the go-to-market, which we're our world within this complex ecosystem is just one component. So I wouldn't say that we found the right formula that if people or companies follow our formula, they are 100% likely to succeed. But our mission in life is just to increase. Like this is a 2022 number. 1.47% of the companies that raised a seed round eventually did an exit through an IPO, became public company. So only 1.47%. Our mission in life as a company is to slightly improve that number. If we can double that number, if we can introduce models and frameworks that people can follow, and just increase their likelihood of succeeding and growing and avoiding those breaking points and pitfalls that we talked about, we have done our job in this world, in our environment.
So being so multidimensional, we should not expect ChatGPT replacing Roy in the next year or two. Because that's
he is a consultant or he is a sales person.
So we should not expect going to a prompt and asking question, how should I architect my revenue? And it asks me some question and say, okay, I'm ChatGPT, I'm telling you exactly what Roy is going to tell you. That is not going to happen. It's so complex, as you said. No, I'm just jokingly saying, I know that it's going to be so complex that, as you said, there are so many dimensions that actually each of them can change the whole thing. So it's very dynamic. And you have to really pay attention to all of these at any given time. And even if you have all the assumptions right, it's still during that journey while you are implementing it. you may discover some new things. You have to be ready in order to recalculate on the fly a number of times to get to the destination you want. It's like you are sending a rocket through a windy situation, and it's not going to get to the destination unless you are recorrecting all the time until you get there.
But I'm an optimist. I would say maybe not tomorrow, but 2 years from today, I would probably bet on ChatGPT and not on Rui.
Okay. Just because,
yeah, just because it can analyze so many different data points. You're coming from data analytics, right?
Sure.
Computers at some point will be able to, again, we're not talking about 100% accuracy, but I think they could connect the dots, many more dots than I can, than a human can. That's a takeaway out of the equation.
That's great. Now, it might be a good segue for my next question that I just wanted to ask you, not just the Gen AI and generative AI, but in general, you know, other types of AI that we see around ourselves as well, and all of them are just, you know, growing and getting better. How do you see kind of businesses and entrepreneurship changing as a result of AI? You may say it's impacting the pricing, or it's impacting the way you build businesses and software businesses, or it's different than the way you build products, or the way, you know, you even do QA of the product to get the product faster. You mentioned that if the product is not a great product, then you don't have a great foundation. Maybe the factory is not going to work, even if you architect it from revenue standpoint correctly, but still there are some other flaws there. Can AI positively or negatively, but positively more importantly, can really impact the way you see and the way we see a software industry and building software, building SaaS products, companies, businesses? What's your take on it? I know it's a wild guess. None of us has, you know, that kind of, you know, future, you know, to know the future crystal ball. We don't have it. But based on whatever you know and everything you know, if you had to, you know, have a wild guess, what would be?
So everything that you said, we're seeing it happening there. It's just a matter of it's still early stages to understand what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not fall in your trap and trying to predict a specific solution, but I would say that everything that we're seeing
mm-hmm.
will allow us, first step is to do more as humans. It will allow us to expedite, whether it's launching a product, whether it's sales process, getting customers quicker to test out our platform and to close a deal, and to be able to do things that are human constraint much faster. So that's the first step. And the second step, and now we're having this discussion internally in our company, how fast is it going to be? Because we are starting to see sales agents,
mm-hmm.
starting to see robots selling. It's mostly demos right now. I haven't been sold buy a robot yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of demos
mm-hmm.
and it's getting closer. I think we're getting closer to the day that robots will replace SDRs, that's for sure. Replace AEs, that might be in specific segments, specific go-to-market motion. So probably enterprise, that there's a lot of need for relationship building. Maybe that's not the way, but lower ACV, high velocity deals. Why do I need to talk to a human? I can talk to a robot. They can give me all the answers that I want. They don't interrupt me. Yeah. So step number two is for us to see robots replacing a lot of the processes and actually humans that are interacting with our customers.
Yeah. And we know that in order for such a thing to happen, we need good data, high quality data, good frameworks. Now, understanding what you do, I don't know if your role is more about really getting engaged and taking action and doing it, or it's more training companies and providing them framework and advising them. And if it's the latter, and you have already developed some framework and you are actually letting companies adopt that framework and go with that framework. And your job would be to coach them through that adoption and how to go through that framework to get the best out of it. Well, in that case, that framework and the data you collect and the way you do it can be done also can help you to really train the AI part, right? So in that way, AI can benefit from the same training. If that's more about you getting involved and implemented and getting into action and doing the work and, you know, that kind of things, maybe a little bit less. But what's the way that you get involved? Do you see yourself at one point creating the framework for the purpose of training kind of the, you know, AI?
Yeah. Yeah. I think... So today, what I do, I usually start off in trying to understand the business. So I access their CRM and understand what's going on. And then I improve their processes and design processes. Mm-hmm. I believe ourselves, we're not a product company. We're a service company.
Sure.
But if we would have wanted to divert and we would have wanted to become a product company, yeah, what limits our ability to plug into their CRM, extract the data based on the data to have the AI come up with what is the ideal by looking at successful plays, sales, customer success, extracting insights, and then acting on those insights, creating processes, and yeah. You see, we're already doing this, right? What is the most successful process based on the ICP, who you're selling to? So, yeah, I don't see a reason why we won't get there soon.
Okay, fantastic. I would like to ask you also if you could, in your view, suggest some events that you think, you know, companies really would benefit from those events, or maybe you guys have some training courses, or maybe you guys have some books that you offer. And I would like to get, you know, your input about those kind of events, conferences, if you can suggest some. Also, if you know some books that you may say, these books are really good and I enjoyed it either personally or professionally, I appreciate those kind of suggestions as well.
All right. Fantastic. So, in our first part of the conversation, we talked about revenue architecture. Mm-hmm. We have a book which includes all the frameworks and models. So for those of you who we were able to spark interest and would want to learn more, the book is called Revenue Architecture, written by our founder, Jocko, and Jocko explains everything there. For those of you who want to learn more, we also do trainings on revenue architecture. And again, revenue architecture is for everybody in mostly B2B, but any recurring revenue company, how to build that revenue factory based on frameworks and models and scientific principles. And we also do courses. This is where I come in. Mm-hmm. I teach what we have developed, what we have written in the book. So we could, the revenue architecture book, revenue architecture course. And for those of you who want to learn more, check out our website, Winning by Design, and you are able to get there. But I know that you talked about a book and, you know, I just did my sales pitch or promotion. There's another book that really helped me. It's not a new book. It's been around, I think, for like 12 years. Mm-hmm. And it's called Sales Manager Survival Guide, Lessons from Sales, Sales Frontline. And it's by the author David Brook. And actually, my father-in-law, who was also in sales, he gave this book to me when I was first promoted from an individual contributor, like a sales manager, from a AE into a sales manager role. And nobody taught me what good sales management looks like. And when I came to him for advice, because he's a sales executive for many years, he gave me this book and told me, hey, you will find everything that you need in this book. So for those of you who are transitioning into that sales management role, Sales Manager Survival Guide by David Brook. I just love it. I read it 12 years ago. It's still here or there. Yeah, I cannot recommend it. So I think it's relevant even today.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for sharing that. It was a great discussion. Thank you very much for joining us again, and hope to get in touch again and having episode 2 of continuation of this discussion sometime next year. Take care.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Arman Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.